a million stories to tell. I'm just one of a million or more stories that can be told.
And we are coming up on 11 a.m. on KBOO Portland. And coming up at 11 is Health and Healthcare Forum with host Roberta Hall. Today, she presents a conversation with Professor Bill Weist on the role of public health in the prevention of war. And at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Joe Meyer speaks with Peggy Moretti and Brandon Spencer Hartle from Restore Oregon about the demolition epidemic in Portland and saving historic downtown buildings from the developer's wrecking ball. Thank you so much, KBOO members, for your generous support to keep KBOO on the air. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
I'd love to wander back.
Hi there, this is Rita Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree on the first and third Monday of each month. Please join me for vintage jazz, country, and western swing. That's on the Noontime Jamboree, the first and third Mondays from noon until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO.
Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. In these programs, we present new information or new insights about old and new health issues. We consider everything from community efforts to improve and extend healthcare to all people, to environmental issues that threaten us all, and to discussions with those individuals and their ideas that can move us forward in the search for health. I'm talking to Bill Weist. He's a member of the Oregon community, but he retired as a public health professor from Northern Arizona University. So, welcome, Bill.
Oh, we're enjoying it. Thank you.
Good. You talked recently to an Oregon State University public health group. You are an affiliate there.
Courtesy faculty member in public health, but specifically international health.
Your title was The Role of Public Health in the Prevention of War. And you've also worked with public health impacts of large corporations, domineering corporations. So those are very interesting topics for our audience. I recorded part of your lecture, and that's what we're going to listen to, but a couple of terms would help the listeners. There's this thing about primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention in public health, and that doesn't always come through to the general public. Primary prevention is really avoiding the problem, I think. But would you just explain how those go?
Certainly, I'll try. We can think of it as sort of a progression of three different phases of a disease, with tertiary prevention being an intervention at the closest point where the disease actually is manifest in its sort of most severe form, I guess you could call it. And that's where we intervene with things that are more familiar to people, like if someone has cancer, they may receive chemotherapy or radiation, for example, or surgery. And that is to help people, you know, to survive. And there may be some things that would be sort of rehabilitative about that particular intervention, and that's called tertiary prevention. Now, if we move back up the chain to the second phase, which is secondary prevention, then that's where we are trying to detect any signs or symptoms of the disease as early as possible. And that's where screening, for example, would come in. Screening would help to detect whether the person has the early stages, the risk factors for that particular disease. Primary prevention is when there is no sign or indication of the disease. It's not being manifest. But we are trying to make changes either as individuals or in our society that would prevent the factors that cause the disease from ever occurring. So some examples of that would be, we try to minimize advertising of cigarettes to prevent children from starting smoking. We have laws about what age you can purchase cigarettes. That's to prevent people from starting smoking. And we have laws about secondhand smoke so that other people are not exposed to the smoke to develop cancers. So that's before there's any risk factors, any signs or symptoms. We're trying to prevent the factors that cause a disease.
So this could be changes in the environment. For instance, controlling pesticides on crops might relate to that.
Yes, that could be another example. So people who do non-chemical organic type of gardening, in a way, they are preventing any exposures to chemicals that might be a risk factor for a disease that would develop later on. This is an older model that's been used in public health since the 1940s. We have moved forward to more of ecological models and ways of looking at things since then, where we look at a variety of factors interacting. And this takes us even closer into what's called systems model, where we have these little networks of factors that are interacting, and they influence each other, and there's feedback loops. And so these things are going on all at the same time, where in the primary, secondary, tertiary model, it's like they aren't really connected and they're occurring at different times, but we know that life is really interactive and we're all connected, and anything that affects one aspect affects another. And so we're looking at health. Again, I brought this whole systems model thinking to the prevention of war.
Now, another term that sometimes is confusing, public health people often are talking about working upstream, and that's the current wish, and they talk about downstream effects. So could you just mention how that works?
Well, the upstream is kind of an ecological model. That's what I was referring to. In a way, it is kind of like the primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. If you can imagine a river flowing, and you're standing there, and people keep passing by in the river like they're drowning. So you decide, well, maybe I should, you know, I can pull people out and continue to pull people out and rescue them. That's sort of like tertiary, you know, prevention. But you think to yourself, well, maybe I should go upstream and see how come these people are in the water and coming downstream. And so you go upstream and you find out essentially what's pushing them into to the river. So that's kind of upstream. So again, it's like the primary prevention. We go up there and we see that, well, it's tobacco advertising, it's the chemicals, it's those things which are essentially causing people to fall into the river of disease and later on develop the disease. So it's similar to the primary, tertiary, secondary form. But we know that there are lots of things that interact all along that river. And there are things that are closer to the river that are causing people to fall in. There are things that are further away from the river that cause them to end up in the river. But the systems model is more the current thinking.
Let's talk about the group that you're a part of that's working on a new book on this topic.
Oh, yes, I'd be glad to. It's a wonderful group. It was formed in 2011. It grew out of the Peace Caucus, which is an affiliate unit of the American Public Health Association. And one of my colleagues did a study of what was taught in schools of public health about war. Essentially, she found that not much, and not much about peace and how to prevent war. And so she formed this group out of the Peace Caucus. And we have members from all over the U.S. as well as some other countries. And we published collectively and in small groups. We've published a number of articles, for example, about the number of deaths in the Iraq War. Some of the members have books published about peace and health. And we published a major article last year in the American Journal of Public Health about the role of public health in the prevention of war. And that's been one of our major emphases, is trying to get information integrated into the curriculum of schools of public health so the public health professionals will understand not only the consequences of war, but what they can do to prevent it. So we've been communicating with the deans of schools of public health and faculty. Members of our group have held workshops and conferences about the prevention of war and role of public health. And we've been writing some editorials to newspapers and a number of different activities like that, all focused on the primary prevention, or that is preventing war before any of the risk factors really manifest themselves. And we are the Public Health Working Group on the Primary Prevention of War.
Well, very good. Thank you very much. Now we'll go on to have some excerpts from your lecture.
Glad to do it.
I've been part of this group, which was started in 2011, grew out of the Peace Caucus of the American Public Health Association. Members of the group have done a number of articles. So the group focus and why we started was we want to integrate the role of public health in the prevention of war into the public health professional training programs. First, we want to ask, well, why public health and what role is there besides that there are injuries and death that occur from war? What relevance does public health have then? Why should we be involved? Well, historically, public health, as you know, we have this ethic of social justice that goes way back to our early founders in public health, that there are injustices that we need to be addressing. And we saw those expressed through a lot of health needs. You're not in public health for the money, if you're directly practicing in public health and studying for that. So you're really in it because you believe in that social justice and fairness, and you have some compassion for things that happen. Those are sort of foundations of public health. Tied into that, we, contrast to many fields, many disciplines, we recognize that there are social, economic, and political causes that contribute to various public health issues. That's a foundation of public health. The World Health Organization has said the role of physicians and other health professionals in the preservation and promotion of peace is the most significant factor for the attainment of health for all. So that's the most significant factor for the attainment of health is peace. So today what I'm going to try to run through and give you some information about the effects of war. If you don't already believe it, that it has some health implications. For the most part, I'm going to focus on the role of militarism as a cause of war. One of the things that this group has done in one of our publications is to propose a list of competencies that public health professionals should be able to practice related to the prevention of war. So some of the health effects of war, we know there are deaths from war. In the 20th century, 190 million deaths directly or indirectly attributable to war. That's more than the other previous four centuries combined. I'm going to be sharing some things with you that may be controversial to you. The whole perspective of this group may be, and the positions that we take on a number of issues. So don't be alarmed. Some things I suggest to you that you don't necessarily believe that hopefully will stimulate you to think about them. So we know not only that there are physical injuries that have been occurring, particularly in the recent wars that we're talking about, Afghanistan and Iraq, but there's also a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder in at least 100,000 from those two wars, and from traumatic brain injury, at least 82,000. 10% or more have experienced concussions in those two wars. We also know that veterans have a very high suicide rate, the older and the younger. During some years that we analyzed, there were more suicides among soldiers than there were combat deaths. Another aspect of military is that women have unique circumstances that they exist in military. Probably around 30% have experienced rape, sexual assaults, 5% gang rapes. And we also know that deployments have put families at higher risk for a number of problems like domestic violence. There's a lot of stress from particularly veterans and their families who experience more than one deployment. But we know that war impacts civilians much higher rates than it does the actual combatants, the military. 85 to 90% of the casualties are civilians. Up to about 2011, there were 500,000 casualties in Iraq, in the Afghanistan wars. But we know that the infrastructure is destroyed. The schools, the hospitals, the clinics, the water, the electricity, and those in themselves then can lead to health problems. Communicable disease, where do they go for health care, medical care? We know that wars have interrupted the eradication of polio. There's some good evidence that it increases HIV. And of course, there are a variety of things about war, particularly landmines, for example, that impact food security, because that land where all those landmines are is no longer available for agriculture. As we are seeing over the last few months, war certainly leads to increases in migration, where people experience some crowding conditions, which arise to a lot of unsanitary conditions, a lack of water, the conflicts that can occur in those camps, very serious results from the immigration. We also know that there are environmental effects from war, and its preparation. Not only, for example, when oil wells are set on fire, as they were particularly in Gulf War that lead to health problems, but more recently from the burning of trash. They think that's contributing to lung problems. But in the preparation for war, some of my colleagues in Arizona are doing measurements of a variety of things. The Navajos feel very strongly that when uranium was mined there to produce bombs, they were the workers, and they believe a lot of their deaths are attributable to that. These colleagues of mine have shown that radiation is very pervasive, that it's in water, it's in the plants, and they even took samples of mutton that people would be eating and found those contaminated as well with a variety of chemicals. Also, storage of nuclear weapons. And because we're in Oregon, we hear more about, probably you're aware of, Hanford, where a lot of waste is stored, where there's leaking containment vessels, and also they're right near earthquake faults. This group particularly focuses on militarism, and we focus on militarism because one thing that it gets very little attention in public health curriculum especially, some of the other topics get more emphasis, but also because it is pervasive and it's hidden. It's become so accepted and pervasive that people really don't recognize it and aren't aware of it. So here is sort of the standard definition. It is a deliberate extension of military objectives and rationale shaping civilian life so that the preparation for war becomes normal. So whether it's building of the bombs, it's the building of the weapons of other kinds, the airplanes, the small arms, it becomes normalized. We just don't really think much about it. It's accepted, part of life. And we become reliant on military and the threat of force to solve problems without really emphasizing other approaches in an equal manner or as much. We have a problem internationally, immediately think of the use of military threat and force without a much long process of diplomacy, for example, or peace efforts. The military institutions become prioritizing in terms of budget, compare the military budget to other aspects of the budget. We've gotten to where we really glorify warriors, and we have this allegiance to the military as being the ultimate protector of freedom, again, rather than even to some extent economics, and particularly in terms of peaceful resolutions to challenges and diplomacy. And those concepts, behavior and myths and languages become inculcated in society. So I would ask you, just real quickly, based upon some of that, can you think of some examples of how that's occurred, where militarism has become ingrained and pervasive in society and sort of not even recognized as such?
How police forces in the United States are now adopting and using military-grade weapons.
Yes, the militarization of the police, yeah. And it's just become sort of accepted. Police departments really depend upon that and live on that money and those donations that they get. Another example?
Military recruiters being allowed to come into high schools.
Yes, good example of that. A friend of mine goes in, does reading with first or second graders, and he said that they came in and distributed water bottles to them that were military camouflage water bottles to recruit. These were elementary schools. Veterans Day, that day was established in the 50s. Originally, it was set up as Armistice and Peace Day, not just to celebrate the end of World War I, but to forever be against war. How many times have you been to a parade for teachers? How many times have you been to a parade for the clergy of any kind? If you go to an athletic event now, there's almost always an honoring of the military at those. And in fact, we found out not too long ago that the Department of Defense is paying the NFL for those events, again, as a recruitment in a sense. Drones that not only are serving military purposes, but are used for policing, even by some universities. And you hear a lot of people talking about the debt of the United States. 22% to 44% of that debt is due to military defense. Weapon sales, number one salesperson in the world for weapons is the United States. 78% of weapons comes from us. And 7 of the top 10 arms producing companies in the world are from the U.S. There is so much collaboration between the Department of Defense, Congress, and the contractors. There's so much collusion there. And the contracts for development of anything in terms of defense or military, they have spread those subcontracts out over the congressional districts of the United States so that those representatives, the residents in their districts, are very dependent for their employment and their income on those industries, those subcontracts from the big contractors like Lockheed Martin and so on. So they don't have to do very much because that member of Congress is going to have to be very brave to stand up against her constituents whose job depends upon that, to vote anything against the military in terms of their budget. So that's going on all the time as well between corporations and the military industry and government. So we're talking about recruiting in school, somebody mentioned. Fantastic example. In the 70s, the draft was done away with so that all the males in here are no longer subject to that, but you still have to register. Essentially what we have now, we call it a poverty draft, because the recruiting targets especially lower income, rural kids, as well as inner city, the urban poor children. There are not only the recruitment directly, but the military, for example, in Chicago, actually runs a charter school. And they use all kinds of recruiting methods. And I'm sure you've heard the term STEM, particularly focused on recruiting women into science and technology, engineering, math. Well, they use that and develop specific programs to attract women by having these programs that focus on that. They take them on the field trips, onto bases, have all these video programs they've developed. And of course, they bring all kinds of equipment onto campus, whether it's a helicopter or a tank or a Humvee, something like that, to entice kids. And there are ROTC. The Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps is one of the major recruitment methods. 30 to 50% or more of the kids participate in that end up going into the military. The No Child Left Behind Act requires schools to participate and allow military recruiters to come in. And if they don't, they can suffer loss of funding and even censure by the Department of Defense. It allows them to have access to private contact information. The U.S. is a signee on the Protocol for the Involvement of Children in Armed Conflict. That treaty prohibits children warriors and recruit. So we are actually acting contrary to that agreement. Research. If you're on a university campus, Department of Defense is the largest funder of research and development in the federal government. More than 350 colleges and universities get 60% of that funding. And that's outside of what's called applied research. It's also outside of scholarships and student aid. And then there's ROTC, which is big on many campuses. Where I retired from, Northern Arizona University was one of the highest ranked ROTCs in the country. And it was very prominent and very celebrated. Communications media, particularly in Iraq, Afghanistan, the media contributes to the general acceptance of war and even can create a fervor for war. And other wars prior to that too, World War II, World War I. The entertainment industry colludes with the Department of Defense, works with the Department of Defense to produce movies, films, and videos. The media used retired military officers as commentators, and nobody revealed, the networks nor these guys, that they were being paid by military contractors to be commentators on the news. So media contributes. That's another example of this militarization. So here's what former President Eisenhower said about all this. Every gun that is made, every warship that's launched, every rocket that's fired is essentially, in the final sense, it signifies a theft. From those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. Martin Luther King had another way of saying it. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. Alternatively, what could we be doing with that money? Just that money alone aspect of it. Well, here are a few examples. Take the 2013 military budget, Department of Defense. We could have used it to provide health care for 270 million children, or we could have paid the salaries of 8 million teachers. Or, more relevant to you, could have been lots of university scholarships funded instead. And some of you who are interested in the environment, wind power for 490 million households. Those are just a few of the things that we could have done with the budget. Also, in contrast to what we devote to violent solutions to problems, we don't put very much into diplomacy and peaceful resolution. How many of you know that there is a United States Institute to Peace? Anybody know about that? Their budget is only $40 million. It's a congressionally established and oversight institute from Congress. It's not very active in terms of sense of engagement in negotiation and diplomacy. It does make some grants, and it does some training, some workshops. So, talk more specifically about public health. This group came up with public health competencies to serve as kind of a menu to choose from to, say, to conduct a workshop, seminars, to incorporate as a whole or as parts of a professional training curriculum, and we based it on several things. One is public health code of ethics. So it says that public health should principally address those fundamental causes, requirements for health, and to prevent those. So we're not talking about treating people who are injured on a battlefield or whose house has been bombed. As important as that is, the principal function of public health is to address those fundamental causes that I've talked about. That's the code of ethics that we operate by as a profession. The World Federation of Public Health made it even more specific. In 2011 resolution they passed, it says public health professionals should become advocates for legislation related to the arms trade, reduction of arms, the ratification of treaties and protocols, and development of initiatives to address the structural causes of war. That's where the World Federation of Public Health Association says we should be focusing. Our own American Public Health Association from 1969 to 2014 passed 34 policies related to war. Official policies that that organization and all public health professionals can take a position on, can advocate for, can use as a background. And those policies are available to all of you. You can go onto the website of APHA, American Public Health Association, and you can look at those. Some of them dealt with opposition to specific weapons, some of them to budget, some of them to specific wars and conflicts. Two of them that we used particularly was the one on militarism and the one that came out in 2009, Public Health Role in the Prevention of War, which was probably the most comprehensive one. And there's been even one since then that was related to veteran services about a year ago. And it also emphasized that we should have this integrated into our training programs for public health professionals. Chiu-Wei reminded me during our visit before we came in here that this is a very political topic, and some people would want to steer away from that, think that health professionals should have nothing to do with politics. Overall, public health is political. There is nothing that you do in public health that's not political. What you choose for your thesis or dissertation or your project will be a political decision. If you don't make a decision, it's a political decision. So what you've learned in your courses to date, how much of it emphasizes how to change or influence legislation, how to change laws, how to enforce laws, to develop treaties, to see whether they're being applied or not, to analyze treaties, those kind of things, as compared to how do you teach somebody to eat a nutritious diet or to plan a program. So here's a quick list, some of the things you can do. Include prevention of war in the curriculum, at least one session in a course in global health somewhere. One of the members of our group was a student at University of Illinois Chicago. He was in a group called Radical Public Health. They organized with the School of Nursing, faculty member who's part of our group, a workshop seminar on public health and war. You could do that here too. You could do your thesis or dissertation project on the prevention of war. And if you belong to a professional organization, whether it's local, whether it's a student group, come out with a position statement about war, about the prevention of war, some anti-war position, something related to what's going on now. What we're recommending is that somehow in every program and service that we provide as a public health professional, somewhere in there should be something about prevention of violence, nonviolent conflict resolution in every health program and service. One thing that we in public health have to do, there are lots of peace organizations. We need to build coalitions with them, and that's how we'd be able to influence presidential policy and congressional policy. We have to have strength in numbers. So I want to end with a poem from Oregon's noted poet laureate, William Stafford. So this is a poem that directly speaks to and addresses this idea of peace and prevention of war. This is the field where the battle did not happen, where the unknown soldier did not die. This is the field where grass joined hands and where no monument stands. The only heroic thing is the sky. No people killed or were killed on this ground. It's hallowed by neglect and has an air so tame that people celebrate it by forgetting its name.
We've been listening to Professor Bill Wiest talk about the role of public health in the prevention of war. The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall. The music was composed by Laurie Childers and played by Laurie Childers and Kent White.
KBOO Community Radio currently has a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. A $100 new or increased donation will become $200 to support the important work of KBOO.
If you become a member at this time or increase your donation over last year, your donation will be matched one-to-one by a group of generous donors up to $10,000. Consider becoming a monthly sustaining member. This can be set up easily and securely online. Over 70% of KBOO's income is from you, our listeners, who take action to become KBOO members.
Go to kboo.fm/support to have your donation matched today, or mail your donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
I used to think democracy a quixotic quest, now merely Sisyphean. In this edition of Democracy Here, we explore the demolition epidemic going on in Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Joe Meyer. Portland is one of the most developer-friendly cities in the nation, and our neighborhoods are losing a century-old home to the wrecking ball every day. Our historic downtown buildings also have little protection from the developer's bottom line. What is the proper balance between property owner rights and the rights of their neighbors? How can today's Portland learn from yesterday's architecture? Are other municipalities doing better? For answers to these questions and more, I spoke with Peggy Moretti and Brandon Spencer Hartle from Restore Oregon. Peggy, will you say a few words about